Several have asked me about the title of the Bible studies, Proverbs and Parables, where the title comes from maybe, or so I thought maybe today I'd better explain where that really comes from. I'm not that creative or brilliant to come up with a subject like that or a title. I've taught Proverbs numerous times during my 41 years, but I just happened to see this little booklet in a Bible bookstore a number of months ago, Proverbs and Parables. And I have borrowed that title from D. Breston, who compiled this little study booklet and calls it Proverbs and Parables, God's Wisdom for Living. So that kind of gave me an inspiration when I saw that title and thought that would be a good connection. I never before have taught Proverbs in the connection with the parables. And several of you have said the same thing, that you have never really thought about the parables in connection with the Proverbs. So we tried to explain that a parable is really a proverb with a story to emphasize its main point. And we've tried to do that, not too successfully sometimes, but that's kind of where the connection comes, joining the Old Testament to the New Testament, giving the parables of Jesus just a slightly added meaning when we connect them with the Proverbs. Shall we begin with a word of prayer? My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. Dear Father, the truth is so plain, and yet it is not obvious. It takes such an act of faith, such an act of sacrifice. Our hearts find it hard to really live this way. So grant us the grace through your Son, your only Son, our Lord, to seek first your kingdom and your righteousness, and by the help of the Holy Spirit, to put you first in all things, and therein to find our true happiness. Grant us a safe and a refreshing weekend. In his name, amen. Well, this is an important day, and I thought it would be well to stop just a few moments this morning for a Scandinavian history lesson. This is Friday. Do you know where the word Friday comes from? The Norse word Frigg, which is the name of the Norse goddess of love. So how can this be an unlucky day? In fact, the Scandinavians claim that Friday is their luckiest day of the entire year. I mean, you know, Friday the 13th, their luckiest day. Well, for most of the rest of us, it's a day of bad luck, kind of like Murphy's Law, you know, if anything can go wrong, it will. And especially on Friday the 13th. Why Friday the 13th? Well, as far as the origin of the observance of the superstition that Friday the 13th is a bad omen, probably stems from Christ's crucifixion on Friday. Probably. That's the origin of it. English history picked up on this as well as others and designated Friday as Hangman's Day. The only day that executions were carried out by hanging on Fridays. Well, why Friday the 13th? What's bad about that? I don't know. The 13th probably comes, believe it or not, from the fact that there were 13 at the Last Supper. Now, why is that unlucky? I don't know, except that Judas was there. And you know what happened to Judas. This is also a Muslim holy day. Anybody know why? When we were in Egypt, the taxi driver said he had really a great weekend, you know. Friday was the Muslim holy day, Saturday was the Jewish holy day, and Sunday was the Christian's holy day. He had 4 days left to work. The Muslim believes Friday is a holy day because Adam was created on Friday. Ever heard that before? I hadn't either. Well, enough history lesson for today. Friday the 13th. And I don't know if you're superstitious about black cats and Friday the 13th and so on. I don't think it really helps one to worry about the day or the color of the cat or anything else. We live under God's grace, and God is our protecting wing, and we dwell under the shadow of it. We have now concluded the first section of the book of Proverbs, which includes the first 9 chapters. The first 9 chapters of Proverbs contain brief essays concerning the merits of divine wisdom and the demerits of worldly wisdom. With chapter 10, which we consider first today, we begin the second section of the book of Proverbs, which extends from chapter 10 through most of chapter 22. Chiefly down to verse 16 of chapter 22. That's section 2 of the book of Proverbs. And if you look just above the first verse of chapter 10, what do you read in most Bibles anyway?
Proverbs of Solomon.
Now, the first 9 chapters are generally considered to have been written or collected by Solomon. And that's probably true. I gave you several illustrations of Proverbs that he wrote that were copied, in a sense, from Proverbs out of Egypt. But in this second section, chapter 10 through chapter 22, these are definitely Solomon's writings. This section has really nothing to put it together with it. There are no overriding themes. You can't say, well, this section and the entire section from chapter 10 through 22 talks about the righteous man and the wicked man. That's it. And almost every proverb in this section is a, two-line either contrasting parallelism or the synonymous parallelism. Remember what a synonymous parallelism is? Both lines say the same thing in just slightly different words. The contrasting parallelism, second line says something almost the opposite, if not the opposite. Look at verse 1, for instance, of chapter 10. A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is a sorrow to his mother. Oh, boy. Why can't we say that a foolish son is a sorrow to his father?
Because when they're bad, they're the mothers.
Uh-huh. Oh, when they're bad, they're mothers. And when they're good, they're dads. Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. I think another factor is that the mother really, in a sense, is the one who molds the child's life. I mean, normally, it's not so true anymore nowadays. Normally, the mother was always at home And whether the child was always at home or comes home from school or so, mom's there, you know, with peanut butter and jelly and fresh cookies. And it's mother that teaches the prayers and so on. So it's at mother's knee that the young child learns a good deal about life. And if that child then later turns the wrong way, who really sorrows the most? The mother does. And of course, nothing can ever happen to sever the relationship between mother and son. I don't care what the son does, he's always, that's his mother, you see, no matter what happens. So it's an interesting contrast. Wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is a sorrow to his mother. If we're looking for a connection between this second section of Proverbs and the first nine chapters, it's very simple and elementary, I'm sure, to say that the righteous person who is portrayed in the second section is a wise man. And the wicked man is an unwise man. And the wise man is righteous, and the unwise is wicked. So there is that connection between the two sections, but that's about the only connection outside of the authorship of Solomon, which for the most part holds true in the first nine chapters too. It's a very sharp contrast between the righteous and the wicked in this section. And I suppose that if there's anything that will come out very clearly in these chapters is the contrast in parallelisms. Most of them will be in contrast rather than synonymous. In the Hebrew frame of reference, life is never compartmentalized like we try to do it. For the Jew, his play, his work, his worship is all one as far as he's concerned. Civil law and religious codes stand side by side. And in Proverbs, it's really impossible to, it is possible to speak of wealth and righteousness in the same breath, in the same line. And I suppose this is best illustrated, I'm sure there are better, but I can't think of any right offhand, best illustrated in the delightful play Fiddler on the Roof. Have you all or anybody seen that? Yeah. What kind of character is Tevye? Tradition, tradition. But he so often does what? Argues with God. Why me? Whether it's got the donkey is lame, or whether a suitor that he doesn't want for his daughter comes along, or he's always looking up and seems to be in a very, very close relationship with God, because he doesn't compartmentalize his life. Everything has to do with God. The cart and the donkey and the suitors for the daughters, and that all is very traditional with the Jew. Well, this section kind of does that same thing, kind of holds up our entire life, whether it's speech or wealth or whatever, holds that up as a unit before God. And we learn from this section those precious things that lead and guide us for a more Christian life every day. Very closely connected to many, many verses in the New Testament, and we'll try to bring out some of those as we go through the section. There are three primary features that stand out in this section. The first is that which a person communicates. Now, can you communicate without saying a word? Very easily. You've heard about or studied maybe or know a good deal about body language. You know, just your body postures. Somebody starts talking to you and you fold your hands and kind of says what?
So much.
Yeah. I don't believe a word you're saying. You don't say it, but just your body language indicates this relationship is broken. You don't need to talk anymore. I know you will, but you don't need to for my sake, see? Okay? All right. Verse 1 of chapter 10 is an introduction. Verses 2 to 5 have to do with possessions. Verses 6 and 7 with blessings. Verses 8 to 14, communications. Verses 15 and 16 about riches. 17 to 21, speech, which is very much the same as communications. 22 to 27, life in God. 28 to 32, the results of righteousness. Now, just arbitrarily, I have chosen 5 verses in chapter 10 to say a word about. You probably would choose 5 different ones. So this is not the last word. If you like another verse to be talked about, if we have time, we certainly will do that. I have chosen verses 10, 12, 16, 19, and 24. Those are the 5 verses that I've chosen. I also like verse 26, especially after all the spinach I ate last night. Like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes is the sluggard to those who send him. Spinach and rhubarb put my teeth on edge. I don't know about you, but well, anyway. Verse 10. Would someone read verse 10 for us, please?
He that winketh with the eye causeth sorrow, but a prating fool shall fall.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Another translation someplace, please?
He who winks the eye causes trouble, but he who boldly reproves makes peace.
Yeah. Any others? Living Bible or Good News or?
He who winks with his eyes causes heartache. But if you talk without thinking, you fall down headlong.
Oh, boy. Somebody in our first session this morning asked the question, why does there seem to be such variance in some of these translations? And really, about the only answer that I can give is, I have the Holman Study Bible, and almost on every page at the bottom in the footnotes is this sentence. The meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain. So what you have in these variant translations is simply what?
Interpretation.
Somebody's guess or interpretation as to what that word means. And somebody else says, oh, no, that's not what it means. It means this. So please don't be upset by the variants. This language, which was in existence, 2,000 years ago, has words in it that we just simply don't know about. We can say that about the English too, can't we? Why was there a new translation to follow the King James Version? Well, we had to, because some of those words mean exactly the opposite nowadays. We simply can't go on with that kind of wrong meaning. Just a word too, and please don't take this wrongly. A word about the Living Bible. Don't use it for Bible study, because it's one man's translation. Well, it's not even a translation. It's kind of a paraphrase. Beautiful. I love to read it. It really clarifies, I think, some points or some words or some issues. But remember, it's the work of one man. You take something like this, or the New English Bible, or so on, and that's the work of literally hundreds of the best scholars in the field. So that's a better Bible to use for Bible study, but for Bible reading, certainly the Living Bible and some of the others are excellent. I'm not trying to demean them at all, but I'm trying to kind of explain to you why there are such variants in translation. Well, he who winks the eye causes trouble. What is a wink? It's something in your eye, and Okay.
That's to get your attention.
All right.
Like a secret.
If I'm speaking to this dear lady right here and I say something to her and then I turn my head and wink at you, what am I doing?
Kidding.
Yeah, don't take seriously what I've said to her, see? Now, a wink can also mean silence. You're winking at the evil that you've seen. You're winking at what you know is wrong, but you kind of wink at it because you don't want to get involved. Silence in the face of evil is probably Satan's strongest weapon. To keep quiet when we should be saying something, but we don't, because we don't want to get involved. You've all read the stories and so on about a young girl or a woman being raped and screaming for help and screaming for help. Nobody does anything. Why?
They don't want to get involved.
They're afraid, you see, that the same thing might happen to them. And I've talked to a number of German theologians as well as German church members, and almost without exception, all of them say that the cardinal sin of the church during Hitler's regime was
silence.
Oh yes, a few spoke out, like Bonhoeffer and Niemöller and so on. You know what happened to them. By and large, the rest of them kept silence. And look what happened. You see, it's a very delicate thing. Should I speak up? Should I speak out? Or should I, you know? And so many say the other thing. Well, what can one person do or say that will influence anything? Be surprised how much has been decided by one vote. How much has been done by one person. See, it's so easy to hide behind the mask of silence. I don't want to get involved. But we are to be frank. We are to be honest. We are, you know, to rock the boat if we think it should be rocked. We are to speak out if we think it should happen. We're seeing a cardinal example of that right now. Where? In South Africa. And believe me, I'm no economist or politician or anything of the kind. I'm not going to make any predictions. I can't do that. But I know that something's going to happen because there are more and more, what? Speaking out against the evil that is taking place. And something's going to happen. Well, verse 12, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offenses. Is that true? Look, for instance, you know it by heart, but if you don't, look at 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13. You know what chapter that is. Great chapter on love. We're not going to read the whole thing. I just want to call your attention to verses 4 through 7. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Does that say something about love covering all offenses? Which New Testament author really has the most to say about the tongue? James. James 5. James 5, verse 20. James 5, verse 20. In fact, that whole chapter has something to say about it, but it's the last verse of James. Let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. Love will cover a multitude of sins. 1 Peter 4, verse 8. 1 Peter 4, verse 8. Above all, hold unfailing your love for one another, since love covers a multitude of sins. When Jesus was asked what the great commandment is, what did he say? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like to it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And he even goes, those are the two commandments, he says, on which hang all the law and the prophets. But he goes one step farther. We are even to love our enemies. Easy to do? I think that's probably the most difficult thing the Lord asks us to do, to love our enemies, to pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you. But that's what Proverbs says. That's what the Lord says. Love covers all offenses. Verse 16, the wage of the righteous leads to life, the gain of the wicked to sin. What do you think is the basic sin of man?
Greed.
Okay. Any other?
Pride.
Okay.
Indifference.
Apathy.
Disobedience.
Self-seeking.
I think all of them can be put under the general heading of selfishness. You know, pride, greed, self, all under selfishness. That is really the basic sin of Eve, wasn't it? Selfishness or greed, or God must have been withholding something from her according to the serpent, you know. So I've got to see what that is. And from then on, selfishness has been one of our cardinal sins and the base of a great deal of it. The Lord gives us two commandments in an effort to control that selfishness, doesn't he? You shall not covet. I know that some persuasions join those two together as one commandment because they separate the first one into two, but it doesn't make any difference. Our basic sin is selfishness. I'm number one. I look out for me first, and that one TV commercial that, what does it advertise? I think it's hair, isn't it? And she says, I'm worth it. Well, you know, if you don't use that kind of shampoo, you're not worth it. That's the inference. Yeah, okay. Well, the wise need to do more than not approval as far as the wage of the righteous is concerned. We need action. And that's why so frequently nothing is done, because we don't translate our faith into action. Remember when we had the parable, he who hears my words and does them, he is the righteous one, he is the wise one. And we have kind of something like that when we turn to Matthew 25, that's also a section that most of you know. Matthew 25, beginning at the 41st verse. Then he will say to those at his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was what?
Hungry.
You gave me no food, no action, see? Nothing done. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink, no action. I was a stranger, you did not welcome me, you didn't even speak to me. Naked, you did not clothe me, no action. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me, no action. Oh, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick? And then Jesus gives us that classic answer, what? Right, you didn't do it unto your neighbor. No action, see? You just sat. You just Have any of you been visited a church and nobody spoke to you? Nobody said hello? They just didn't even care whether you were there or not. We had that experience about a month ago. Went to a different church and the pastor even introduced us, said I just retired, was living in the area and hoped that we would become involved and so on. And had to stand up. My wife hates that. Had to stand up. Do you know at the end of that service, not even the people that were sitting on either side of us said hello. Nobody in that church spoke. And they knew who we were. You know, kind of gives you a funny feeling. Well, anyway, the point is that action is required on the part of Christ's disciples in order to do what? To show love, to show concern, to show caring. All right. Verse 19. Will someone read that for us?
In the multitude of words there wanteth not sin, but he that refraineth his lips is wise.
Now we've got somebody that's talking too much. What's wrong with many words? Transgression is not lacking. The temptation to do what is present?
Embellish it.
Say too much. Too many words can very easily lead into gossiping about saying things that we shouldn't say. There's the old saying that says, if you never repeat anything you've heard, there you have lost nothing. You've all played the game, I'm sure, where you sit in a circle and the leader says a very short sentence to the one person and then it goes around the circle. And what happens to it as it goes around the circle?
Changes.
You don't even recognize it when it gets back, do you? You started out with a short sentence and you end up with a paragraph that isn't even related to the original statement. Why? Why?
You're not listening.
Okay, you're not listening.
You
have to add your own interpretation. The fish gets bigger and everything is enlarged and because you think you have to add your interpretation to it. We don't. Now, the Lord says, whatever is more than yea, yea, and nay, nay is of the devil. But have you ever tried to visit with somebody who said, yes? Yeah. Oh, no. What do you generally say to them? Goodbye. I mean, you just can't visit with anybody like that. They're really taking the Lord's word to heart, but there's quite a difference between an intelligent conversation and many, many words. He who restrains his lips is prudent, he's wise. He says something maybe only when talked to or asked or addressed. Some people never hear what the other person says to them. Why? You're already planning to do what you're going to say in response, but you don't even hear what they say. You see that portrayed once in a while in a TV show or so on, and the wife talks to the husband, and he says, yes. She says something else, yes. I'm going to leave you forever, yes. Oh, good and well, there's no communication going on there at all. Well, so, verse 19 is descriptive of the loose tongue. Back to James. Nobody says more about the tongue than James. And chapter 3 really describes the tongue. He says in verse 6, the tongue is a fire. The tongue is an unrighteous world. No human being can tame that tongue. It's a restless evil full of deadly poison. Because with it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. Really? Absolutely. This old mother is taking more trouble than anything in our whole body. And somebody mentioned at the early class this morning that this is the strongest muscle in the body. The tongue. And there's no doubt about it that the tongue gets us into more trouble than any other member of our body. Because it's so easy to want. Yuck. No thought behind what we're saying. Just talk. Well, the loose tongue. Look at verse 24. What the wicked dreads will come upon him, but the desire of the righteous will be granted. Another word for dreads, of course, is what the wicked fears will come upon him. Was it Roosevelt that says we have nothing to fear but fear itself? Yeah. And this has a good deal to say about that kind of fear. What the wicked fears will come upon him. Murphy's Law, huh? If anything can go wrong, it will. Even on the 13th. What the wicked dreads will come upon him, but the desire of the righteous will be granted. Well, in Romans, Paul says it's the nature of human conflict and shows us why people act as they do. There is no sin that does not come back as a sorrow. I'd like to underline that. There is no sin that does not come back as a sorrow. What the wicked fears will come upon him, but the desire of the righteous will be granted. Do good men's hopes, good people's hopes, all come true?
No.
Look at Jeremiah. One of the most unhappy prophets that's pictured for us in the Old Testament. One of the most faithful. But my goodness, if he wasn't up to the mud in the pit, he was being persecuted. Nobody listened to poor Jeremiah. Nobody. His hopes certainly weren't realized as far as his message was concerned, his message of doom. Think of Jesus. What happened to him? He was crucified. Sure, the resurrection came because of his conquering of sin, death, and the grave. But here he goes about doing good and he's crucified. Think about the apostle, or let's look at Stephen first. What happened to Stephen?
Stone.
But what did he see in his final moments of life? The heavens opened and he saw Jesus. Of course, that brought on the final stoning, didn't it? That's blasphemy. What about the Apostle Paul? You know, I just finished teaching a course on Paul in our Sunday morning Bible classes, and every Sunday morning, this man's life and teachings and so on just overwhelmed me. I don't know how that man, at the end of his life, could say what he did. You know what he says in 2 Timothy 4, let's see, the verses 7 and 8, you've memorized them and heard them many times. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. And what had happened to that man during his life? Read 2 Corinthians 11 sometime and get that catalog of all that man suffered. Were his hopes realized? As far as the thorn in his flesh? Jesus says what? I'm sorry. I'll give you the strength to bear it, but I won't take it away from you. And numerous things happened to this man that were not in his life's plan, I'm sure. But what can he say at the end? I have kept the faith. There's a crown of righteousness laid up for me. So even though immediately or during the life your hopes are not realized, the Christian has nothing to worry about, because in the hereafter he will be forever with his Lord. So if we keep the faith, if we remain faithful, that is what's important. Chapter 11, verse 1. a famous verse that I'm sure you've heard many times. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. It was a practice, I won't say general, but it was a practice in the Old Testament that when the trader bought, he used a heavy stone. And when he turned around and sold that product, then he used the light stone. He got more for his money with the heavy stone, and then got more for his money when he sold with the light stone. Buying and selling. One of my very favorite pictures, and it's because I'm a collector of his, in my collection is Norman Rockwell's picture of the butcher. Remember that? The lady is buying her meat. And here is the scale face with the hand going on it, and here's the what do you call it? The place where you put the meat, where it's going to be weighed. They're both looking up at the scale and watching it. And the butcher has his finger on the top of the plate, pushing it down, and the lady has her finger underneath it, pushing it up. A false balance is an abomination, but a just weight is his delight. She was going to make sure. In fact, she was going to help him out even a little bit to get that just weight. Well, verse 13. He who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is trustworthy in spirit keeps a thing hidden. How do you like people that tell secrets that you've told to them? You like them?
No trust. Don't trust.
No trust. But how many times have you heard, you know? Now, I'll tell you this, but you promise you won't tell anybody else. Oh, yeah, sure. So you tell them. And then you turn around and say what? I'll tell you this, but you promise not to tell anybody. So what happens? Gossip and the ill tale and, you know, you can ruin a person's reputation by just a sentence or two. Because words can do what? Hurt. Kill. Words can cause a deeper cut, a deeper hurt than anything else. You can have a gunshot wound, or you can have an arm broken, or you can most anything else, but and it will heal. But words, and you can say, I'm sorry 1,000 times. And when you finish, they say, but you said, right? Be careful. Use the tongue wisely. He who goes about as a talebearer does reveal secrets. He just can't help it because that's his business. He just goes around as the tattletale, you know. And even in Fiddler on the Roof, who is the tattletale? The matchmaker, right? Oh, because she'll say anything in order to do what? Make a match. Okay. But he who is trustworthy in spirit keeps a thing hidden. Words have tremendous power. God was certainly wise when he set aside 2 commandments that deal with the tongue. The first one is what? You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. How do you do that? Oh, damn it, go to hell. Cursing. Don't take the name of the Lord in vain. The second commandment that deals with the tongue? The 8th, do not bear false witness against your neighbor. 2 commandments dealing with the tongue. That's how important the Lord thinks that little member is. Well, we heard yesterday, was it last night, yesterday afternoon, about how much a doctor should tell his patient. And Ralph admitted that a number of years ago, while maybe the doctor didn't actually lie to the patient, at least he said, oh, everything will be all right. Which, I mean, he knew it wouldn't. Until now, the doctors seem to be more on the side of saying to a patient pretty much what his condition is. But how devastating those words can be. Remember what he said? Or one of you said? Well, the moment the doctor said, well, there's really no hope, from that moment down, her husband went down very fast. Words, you see, can give hope or they can destroy you. Words can hurt, words can heal. Look at verse 14. Where there is no guidance, a people falls. But in an abundance of counselors, there is safety. The King James says, where there is no counsel, doesn't mean church counsel. No advice, no counsel. And this is a famous saying, you know, where there is no counsel, the people fall. Why? They don't have a leader. They don't have good counsel.
Now Beck says, where there's nobody to lead them, an army will fall.
Absolutely.
But many advisors can save it.
Absolutely. Turn it over to a committee. Two heads are always better than one, right? Even the army doctors now, we've been kind of close to this, maybe some of you have, we're having quite a to-do over at Madigan Hospital, just outside of Tacoma and Fort Lewis, and finally now the government has decided that because there are so many malpractice suits and so on against the doctors in the Army, that now finally the government is saying, get a second opinion. Two heads are always better than one. And they figure that many operations will be, you know, not necessary and so on, simply because somebody else has come in and looked the situation over. Then in verse 21, be assured an evil man will not go unpunished, but those who are righteous will be delivered. Do you believe that? An evil man will not go unpunished?
Sometimes it seems like they do get punished.
Okay. I don't have the latest statistics, and so I'm not going to mention any figures at all, but every once in a while you hear or read about the vast number of murders that haven't been solved. Will they be?
It doesn't say when.
It does not say when. Evil will be punished. You can rest assured on that. All of Scripture testifies to that. Evil will be punished. But maybe not in your day. And the second thing, maybe not in your way. Remember James and John in that Samaritan village that refused to rent a room to Jesus and his disciples? Remember what they wanted to do? Let's call down fire and brimstone from heaven and wipe them off the face of the earth. The idea that they wouldn't give us lodging. Did Jesus do that? You simply don't determine for God when he's going to punish evil or to take care of a situation. And forgive me, I am a sinner. Many times I have said to God, why don't you do something about the ungodly? Especially in Russia, the leaders. I'm not talking about the people. Those of you who've been to Russia know that there are thousands, tens of thousands of fine believing Christians like you and I, but it's the leaders. God, why don't you do something about that? Idi Amin. How can God permit these things to go on? And I have all kinds of ways in which I think he should take care of him. But he doesn't. Why? He isn't ready. God is love. God is merciful. I'm not sometimes. You know. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't get me into that. That's terrific. Well, five more verses, just from 24 to 28. Chapter 11, 24 to 28. These have to do with the principle of generosity and is really the basis for the parable today. For instance, one man gives freely yet grows all the richer. Another withholds what he should give and only suffers want. Is that true? Absolutely. There are many, many stories that show the proof of that. Letourneau is one. There are hundreds of others. A liberal man will be enriched. One who waters will himself be watered. People curse him who holds back grain, but a blessing is on the head of him who sells it. Liberality, generosity is always rewarded, especially when we share, first of all, with the Lord what he has given us. Then somehow or other, all of our other wants are taken care of. And I can testify to the fact that many times when I think I don't have any money left in my checking account, or I'm not too good at keeping that thing balanced, you know, check by check, and I'll ask the teller, what's my balance? And she runs it out on the computer, and where did all that money come from? I haven't put a deposit in for a long time. I don't really know. It's proven that when you share what God has given you, he takes care of you. There's just no doubt about that.
Usually more than you ever
gave. Oh, my, yes. Many, many times over. Right. Luke 16, verses 19 through 31, the parable for the day, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. Just several introductory remarks. We don't have much time. Jesus does not even call this a parable, but it is always listed among the parables of Jesus. And because names are used, some Bible scholars believe this is based on a historical event. Now, whether it is or not is not for us to decide today. But let's look at it. Whether it's a parable or not, it has a powerful lesson to teach to us. This parable, believe it or not, how many of you know anything about Albert Schweitzer? Something, okay. A great musician, a great composer, a great theologian, a great surgeon. This parable is responsible for his building his hospital in Lombarini in Africa. This parable. Because after he read this parable and studied it, he decided that Africa was Lazarus and needed help. So that's just a little PS about what important parts some of the Bible play in a person's life. This is a favorite of Albert Schweitzer. Okay, it's divided into three acts. And the first act deals with Dives, and it's simply, we say Dives because that's the word for rich. He was a very wealthy man, wasn't he? How do we know that? Purple, fine linen, fared sumptuously at every meal. You don't do that if you're poor. Only the very, very wealthy could afford purple and fine linen. Who's lying at the gate? A beggar by the name of Lazarus. Don't ever confuse this Lazarus with the brother of Mary and Martha. No connection whatsoever, though some have tried to do that. No connection. What's the matter with Lazarus? What's he doing there? He's hungry. And the best place he feels to be is at the gate of this rich man. Why? He might get something to eat. In fact, it was at that gate, apparently, that the servants came with their, compostable things. No, is that right? Yeah, okay. And shook out the tablecloth and scraped off the dishes. Why? That's where the dogs were. The dogs were fed outside the gate. And here is Lazarus doing what? Grabbing everything that he can to feed himself. Dives never saw Lazarus. Never saw him. By that I mean what? Didn't care whether he was there or not. Never gave him any food. Never took care of him. The second act, what happens?
The dogs were fed.
Well, that's part of the first act, yeah. That's dessert for the dogs. Now they come and lick his sores. Oh, that's so revolting.
Lazarus died.
They both died. Lazarus went where? Up. Dives went down. Isn't that strange that their roles are completely and absolutely reversed? Aha! But Dives looks up and, you know, this is parable, this is story. Looks up and sees what? Sees Abraham. And who does he have in his bosom? Lazarus. Oh, my dear friend, in his bosom. That means close. And Dives says to Abraham what? Please send Lazarus down here. Still treating him as a servant or a beggar. Please send Lazarus down here with a drop of water on his finger to cool my tongue. Because, baby, it's hot down here. Just a drop of water is all he's asking for. But he's asking for water just like Lazarus asked for bread or food. Right. How completely the roles are reversed. But then Abraham has something to say, and he says what?
Remember, and you did what you did.
I'm sorry. In your lifetime, you had every good thing, and Lazarus had nothing. Now he has everything, and you are begging. But I can't do anything for you. Why not?
There's a wide chasm.
There's no road from heaven to hell. There certainly isn't any road from hell to heaven. Now notice, please, that nowhere does Dives ask for what?
Forgiveness
to come out of hell. Not one word. He simply wants relief. But when he finds out that can't be given, then he says what?
Send.
Hey, I don't want any of the rest of my family in this place. Send the gospel to my five brothers. I don't want them coming here. And then the admonition is what? Won't do any good. I mean, they've got Moses and the prophets. If they don't believe them, neither will they believe though someone rose from the dead. Now that's kind of a final jibe that Jesus is putting into this story, because in his audience are the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees believe in the resurrection, the Sadducees do not. And he's simply putting this in as kind of a barb against the Sadducees. They won't believe even though there is a resurrection. Well, you know, if many people had their wish, they would believe in Jesus if they could only see him. Have you ever heard that? Mm-hmm. Oh, if I only could see him, I'd believe in him right now. What happened to the thousands who saw him? They didn't believe. Who was present at the crucifixion? A couple women and John. Where were those thousands that he had healed? Where were those thousands who followed him all over the place? They weren't there. Some go so far as to say, oh, if I could only see one of his miracles, he'd heal my mother or take care of my father, or then I would believe. Really?
No way. They soon forget.
Pardon?
They soon forget.
They soon forget, right. Well, how secure do you feel in the love of Jesus? Very secure, I hope. Very secure. How do you look upon the first commandment? You know, if we really kept that commandment, we wouldn't need the other nine. If we always put the Lord first, we wouldn't need the other nine. But he knew that we wouldn't, so he gave us the rest as guides for daily living. Well, this generosity, this relationship, all related to Proverbs 10 and 11, especially to 11, especially to those last few verses of liberality, generosity, and so on, which Dives could never be accused of. Well, thank you.
One of those examples.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. On Monday morning, Proverbs 12 and 13. The parable is Matthew 25, the 10 virgins, 5 wise, 5 foolish. Very interesting study. We hope